ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Medialand, your weekly look at what's happening behind the scenes and on your screens. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
This week, the government finally seems to be taking action on the global tech players paying their way.
Big media companies announce cuts as the advertising market weakens.
And in the age of media consolidation, is there space for a smaller player? Hannah Ferguson joins us. It's time for my favourite topic, Viv, the intricacies of how the government can get the platforms to help fund Australian journalism without falling out with Donald Trump. I assume that's everyone else's favourite topic too.
What actually happened? Why is it up there on the agenda?
Well, this week, so the news bargaining incentive, and I've noticed that all of a sudden everyone started using the acronym NBI. So that presumably means that it's here to stay. So Labour began to flesh out their plans around this idea that they first floated about 11 months ago. They published a Treasury document as a kind of consultation paper that people have about a month to respond to, which is perfect timing for me, Viv, because I had a long plane flight on the way back from Perth to the East Coast. It gave me lots of time to kind of read the intricacies of it.
Are we talking about the big tech giants paying companies that are on social media for their news, or are we talking about those big traditional media companies like News Corp and Nine getting money from the tech giants? How do they determine who gets it?
Yeah, that's absolutely the key central question. So firstly, this is targeted at what we might call the search giants and the social giants. So you might remember we had the News Media Bargaining Code, which was the previous policy, which is still exists as law, and that was to effectively bring Google and Facebook, what's now known as Meta, to the table. And they, rather than being caught up in that, they did deals with various news companies to effectively help fund them. Now, this time around, this policy is effectively to try and find a way of addressing the fact that Meta later pulled out of these deals. So now there'll be a policy. Initially, people were calling it a levy. Now they're talking about it as penalties or fines. But effectively, for the big platforms, those who have Australian revenues, and there's a slight question mark, but I think they mean advertising revenues of over $250 million a year, will have a choice of either effectively having their revenues, this levy applied and taken away from them by the government, or they can save some money on that by instead doing deals with media companies and effectively helping fund local media. But the question you were asking about big or small isn't really fully answered in that document.
Yeah, Tim, I don't mean to be rude because you mentioned at the top that it was your favourite topic, but I feel like we're kind of stuck in a never-ending loop with this policy or this platform being called different things, whether it's an incentive, whether it's a code, whether these companies are designated. And then the tech giants threaten to do something such as maybe remove themselves from Australia or take certain aggressive action. And then we're sort of back talking about it again. Is this time different?
Look, the major difference this time in terms of a new development is that there's a month-long consultation. So at the end of that period, effectively the government will be ready to move. Now, what this document makes clear, and by the way, this document has been sitting around for many months, so it's only now been released. And what's clear in that document is it's talking about anybody who's financial year started in 2025. So here we are, you know, we're many months in. So there is a real possibility that these, we now seem to be calling them fines, might apply to platforms for a period where they didn't even know quite what the rules were going to be. And the big challenge is that thing of, you know, are they just going to go and have conversations with the big end of town, which was what happened last time. And you might remember when Chris Jans was our guest, who now is the proprietor of Capital Brief, but back in the day was the boss of Fairfax Media's publishing arm, and then Nines when that took over. He was the person who negotiated those deals and made the point that it was the big end of town who did well, and there was no guarantee. It meant journalism jobs, because it was about guaranteeing profits and about retiring debt for the shareholders. So the potential criticism, and certainly the question is how does this become applied to all of the media?
Well, speaking about journalism jobs, we'll be talking about the turbulent week for domestic media companies next. So as I mentioned, Tim, it's been a tough week for domestic media companies who are all in their own ways reacting to what could be described as a softening advertising market. In particular, it was bad news, good news, bad news week for ARN Media, which owns the radio networks KIIS and Gold.
Yeah, it was such a big week actually for me. There was so much happening. But yeah, just to kick off with ARN, for want of starting somewhere. So the first bit of ARN's bad news was that they announced that their full year profits, so until the end of December, they could be down by 27%. And that, you know, as you say, is because of the softening advertising market. And that will likely mean even more radio job losses. They did have a little bit of good news, which was that the Victorian Office of Public Prosecutions aren't going to charge Carl Sanderlands or Jackie Henderson for contempt over potentially prejudicial comments that were made on air during the so-called mushroom murder trial of Erin Patterson. And that same news applies to Mamma Mia as well. But then there was more bad news for ARN to finish the week with the ACMA, the Australian Communications and Media Authority, saying that it plans to ban Kyle and Jackie O from talking about sex, and their Sydney radio license could be on the line.
Yeah, I actually tuned into the Kyle and Jackie O show after that news about ACMA's potential action became public, and Kyle was sort of talking about how it was unfair and he doesn't know what to do anymore, because his perspective was people can say all sorts of things on podcasts. He cited the likes of the Joe Rogan podcast and Call Her Daddy, both of which are American podcasts, often at the top of the charts here, that say quite explicit things. His argument was you can do what you want on the internet, you can do what you want on podcasts. This is fundamentally unfair and a campaign that's being driven by a small minority of activists and everybody else in the community across various demographics and sectors love us. It's a bit different though, isn't it? Because they are going out, you know, on what we would have called back in the day on the radio waves. I know they argue that they are an entertainment company and an entertainment brand, but that is the difference, isn't it? That the government can impose these sanctions or these conditions because they have a radio license.
That's the key thing. You know, there is a value to having a TV license. There's a value to having a radio license. The networks don't actually have to pay as much as you might think to have those. And of course, the ability to reach a huge amount of people through those broadcasting licenses allows these companies to make money. And the kind of the public deal is that there have to be standards which are co-regulated by ACMA, the ACMA, and that means standards. And that includes decency standards, which, as we've talked around previously, had been breached. And the next stage after you breach those a few times is your license can be at risk. So we've now hit that point where the license does seem to be at risk, and ARN will have to decide what they do about that.
Is it actually at risk, though? Kyle was talking about, you know, the sort of attack on free speech that he perceives this to be, but Kyle and Jackie O and the program and the various stations that they've been on in the past have been subject to various breaches, various criticisms, various campaigns, and they're still on the air in 2025. So is it a realistic possibility that they're going to be pulled?
this is the fascinating thing to me. So back when they were on Today FM, which was owned by Southern Cross or Stereo, there was a license condition attached to the Sydney license after they'd made previous breaches. Now, that was with the previous employer, so that was wiped out when they left. So there was, from that point onwards, there was the threat that the license could be suspended or taken away, and it never happened. And as far as I've been able to work out, Viv, I don't think a commercial radio license in Australia has ever actually been suspended or taken away. So whether the watchdog has the appetite to do something differently this time, we will find out.
And ARN weren't the only ones with some bad news emerging this week. Nine, which owns the television network Nine, as well as streaming business Stan and various online and print publications such as the Sydney Morning Herald, the Brisbane Times, The Age, they announced that they would be having cuts across their television department as well.
Yeah, that's right. And Seven has done the same thing as well. So, you know, we're seeing greater cuts. And then just to be clear, that it's not just TV and radio. The one of the big out-of-home advertising companies, oOh!media, having had to kind of really reduce its operations in New Zealand, has announced that they're going to have a bad finish to the year as well. So for Australia's commercially funded media, this is a really bad finish to 2025. You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
Now, we're always talking about media companies trying to get bigger in order to survive.
But that may not be the only way to do it, Tim.
That's right, Viv. Hannah Ferguson set up Cheek Media in 2020 and has been building an independent media company, which she described in an Australian Press Club appearance as an incredibly profitable business. She's the co-host of Cheek's podcast, Big Small Talk, and the author of Bite Back and 2024's Taboo.
Hannah, thank you so much for joining us on Medialand. I first became aware of Cheek Media probably on Instagram when people started sharing those very easy to digest, very visually appealing tiles that sort of summarized news stories or perspectives. And to me, it felt like it came out of nowhere and was suddenly all over my algorithm. I'm sure you don't feel that it just came from nowhere. But for anyone listening to Medialand who maybe doesn't know Cheek or doesn't know that they have actually seen your content, how would you describe it? Like, what is it that you do at Cheek Media?
So Cheek is an independent commentary platform that is very honest in the fact that it's progressive commentary that's trying to challenge the Murdoch media landscape in Australia. But it's predominantly run through Instagram. We also have a podcast, Big Small Talk, that does news and pop culture. But fundamentally, the idea is that when I was 22 and consuming news and media and really wanting to kind of explore more political views, more of my activism, more of my advocacy, I was frustrated by the fact that news wasn't made for young people's voices to be included or for the language we needed to actually learn the fundamentals around the power systems in this country. And so I really wanted Cheek to be accessible, digestible, engaging opinions on the news that spoke to and represented the views of young people in Australia.
And it's a few years in now. Does doing this make as much sense now as it did when you started?
I think it makes more sense, honestly. I think that, you know, at the time, late 2020 when Cheek was established, really, it was December of 2020. And moving into 2021, we had Brittany Higgins come forward and tell her story. We had Grace Tame named Australian of the Year. We had our Attorney General at the time, Christian Porter, who was accused of a historic allegation of rape. And to be speaking to young women in Australia as the Me Too movement really took hold here was incredibly important heading into the 2022 election, federal election, where Scott Morrison was our Prime Minister at the time. And I think at the time, at that sort of moment in Australia, it was very much that women were coming forward and using their voices and wanting to have the tools and the language to articulate our positions. But moving into this disinformation and misinformation era now, we're facing down Trump's presidency, we're facing a global swing to the right. and continuing to advocate from this space and hold a progressive framework there has become actually more important, I think, to continue challenging the centrism of Australia's Labor Party, which I think has failed at so many levels to represent or respond to the ask that Australians have put forward, but also to continue challenging the narratives around the normalisation of someone like Donald Trump.
So your political position is obviously quite clear. You made it clear in your opening answer that you're very transparent about that. You've just happily spoken about your views there. Do you think media organisations in this country are as transparent with their political position as you are? Are you trying to deliberately be transparent to make a point that they're not transparent?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, there are a lot of media organisations and journalists in this country that do incredible work and should pursue objectivity in their work. I don't think any of us can ever be objective. I think we all have bias. We all have to vote. We all have political opinions, especially the people working in this space. But I think that there are a lot of media organisations, entities, mastheads in this country that are propagating clear agendas for an individual, for the vested interests of corporations in this country, for particular agendas driven by particular individuals, often the billionaires that run these platforms. And it's very clear without actually being said. And I think in order to respond to that and sort of bring a different kind of strength to the conversation, my view is if I articulate exactly what I think and exactly how I formed my views to the people that follow me and trust me, that audience then knows where I stand, how I've made my decision and how they can disagree with me healthily, how they can have respectful discussions and debates with me. But it's not that I want people to agree. I want people to have a respectful dialogue and I want to make the public square interesting again. And so I think coming at that with a transparency makes all the difference.
Speaking of billionaires who run platforms or organizations, though, a huge part of your audience is on social media, which is owned by Meta, which is owned by an American billionaire, Mark Zuckerberg, many of whom would argue probably has his own political views and agenda that he pushes via that algorithm. So how do you sort of balance that when you've got a borrowed audience on a platform that probably is owned by someone you fundamentally disagree with?
Oh, it's tough. Every single day I wake up and think genuinely and question, every day I wake up and question whether I can make good things in a bad place and whether I can contribute positively to somewhere that I believe is evil and run by people who are at worst evil, but at best careless, I think, in their approach to algorithms and the harm they cause to people from every demographic around the world. I think that, you know, social media is a net negative for the populations that exist in those ecosystems, but also understanding that that is a shopfront, really, a retail storefront to the work that I do in having a podcast, in having a growing Substack platform, in having a functional website, and having all of the things that I do beyond just Instagram for cheek. This is just one element of a broader ecosystem I'm trying to build out so that eventually I can move off and no longer depend on Meta and other platforms.
Yeah, I'm interested that you've moved on to Substack. I was looking and I see you already have more than 20,000 subscribers there. What does that sort of long-form opportunity give you that Instagram or podcasts doesn't?
It gives us the opportunity to actually challenge people's shortening attention spans. I think one of the biggest issues actually trying to move on to Substack right now is I want to offer longer form pieces where we're commissioning writers at above industry rates to write those pieces from demographics and from perspectives that aren't really centered in mainstream media as well. Like, that is absolutely an objective of Cheek, is to platform voices that aren't being seen or heard elsewhere in the media. And so I think offering that opportunity to pay writers or people who aren't even writers to do that has been incredibly sort of the best part of our growth this year, I think, as a platform. But knowing that a lot of the time it's hard to get people to move from Instagram and from TikTok because everyone wants a 10-second soundbite in a video, not a longer form piece with a genuinely nuanced perspective, has been tough to challenge as well.
And something, you know, funny enough, you know, as Viv alludes to with Instagram, Substack has its own issues as a platform as well. And, and for the record, I, you know, until very recently had my own Substack platform as well. And I certainly wrestled at times from the reputational challenge of their occasional platforming of what could be described as Nazi adjacent content. How do you think about that with sort of your own brand being there on Substack?
Oh, I grapple with that every day too. When we launched on Substack and had like 1,000 paid subscribers, I had a lot of people complain that I shouldn't be on Substack because they do allow for that kind of content to be distributed. And I completely agree with the criticism, but I've also just had 1,000 people pay for a 12-month subscription through that platform. It's very difficult to then say, okay, well, that's cancelled and we'll move to a new one, when every platform that is large in any social media ecosystem, whether it be Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, or Substack, all of those harmful views and extreme ideas are being platformed. And I do find it tough as well when individuals in my audience criticize me for existing on Substack when they're commenting through a platform like Meta to make that accusation too, because I think there's a great irony in the fact that all of these platforms are facilitating harm in different ways, and yet we all exist there. And so it's how do you make good in a bad place is the continual moral question that I'm facing and struggle with too.
You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National with Tim Burrows and me, Vivian Kelly. We're speaking to Hannah Ferguson, who is the founder of Cheek Media. Hannah, when you talk about progressive politics and your media company, I think one of the things you've been critical of News Corp for is for sort of stoking what you see as division and playing identity politics. Would they contend that you do the same thing?
One of my most consistent interview questions is, are you the Rupert Murdoch of the left? Which is like a crazy accusation. Also hilarious that anyone think I would have any power like that. I think the immediate combat to that is I am, yes, obviously transparent in my views, but I am not immune to criticism or to feedback. I have received a lot of feedback over the last year in particular, facing down the US and the Australian elections, and have really tried to take that on board and evolve the offering of Cheek to respond to the community that want better from me. And I think that those accusations might fly around, but the power of the Murdoch media to drive a right-wing agenda has genuinely shaped the global politics we're currently living in. And to kind of leverage an accusation like that against a 27-year-old who makes up a very small part of the Australian media ecosystem and just tries to offer progressive views that counteract the right-wing extremism we're seeing flood the zone right now seems a bit ridiculous to me.
So, Hannah, we mentioned in the intro that you gave a speech at the Australian Press Club and you covered a lot of ground there, but one of the things you talked about was the term influencer, which is used to describe so many different types of people in 2025. Sometimes it's somebody who was on Big Brother and now people want to continue to watch their lives online. It might be someone who's a journalist. It might be someone who's very conventionally attractive and can peddle various products to their millions of followers. You described the term as deeply misogynistic, though. What is it about that word in particular that you don't like?
I think it's important to say at the forefront of this that the word influencer is inherently unproblematic, right? To say that someone holds influence and therefore is an influencer is totally fine at its baseline definition. The issue is not the word, it's the way that the Murdoch media has projected a really misogynistic meaning onto that language. So when you think of an influencer, if we just were to picture it, right, immediately, I'm thinking of a young blonde woman who lives on the Gold Coast and sells skinny me tea, right? Because that is how successful the right-wing media has been in driving that agenda as to sort of minimizing women in the space, making it out to be women who sell activewear, who are conventionally attractive, who are young, and it's making them feel superficial, it's making them feel money hungry, and it's making them feel sort of, it's minimizing their intelligence and capacity, because really a lot of these people are successful entrepreneurs. But we would never describe men that way. And I think if we're seeing the word influencer and immediately thinking of a young woman online, we're probably seeing the misogynistic language take hold there.
There's often been a criticism of mainstream media that there's just a gap between their output and what audiences want. Mm. And that gap seems particularly big when it comes to women. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think that, you know, the younger women in this country, I mean, and I'm here, I'm talking actually, honestly, under the age of 40, I think would be, you know, I think it's actually all women increasingly so too. I think that is why we're seeing the rise of the teal movement in Australia, because women in Australia generally have been disappointed in the lack of coverage and the lack of reflection of our voices and our views in the Australian media. And I think that legacy media increasingly leans into old stereotypes and stigmas of what women are interested in, what they're passionate about, what we want to hear about. And that's why podcasting is dominated by women in Australia. I would say that there's so many more podcast offerings for women, whether it be in the space of health, of business, of beauty, of politics, whatever it is, there is a hunger and there is a thirst for our diversity of content to be consumed. And I think that there's actually a lot of economic value that women bring to the table that is being underestimated by Australian legacy media and mainstream media. And I think that that gap is increasing because every time the podcasting world, or the content creation world, tries to stand up and actually create a more significant offering for women, instead of actually legacy media sort of responding and meeting us where we are, they become defensive and territorial and shut down and almost shut the gates on any opportunity they have to lean into this, what is a very commercially viable model. And I think that the complete denial or ability to have a conversation about what they're lacking is the reason they're losing relevance as well.
Hannah Ferguson, the founder of Cheek Media, thank you so much for joining us on Medialand today.
Thank you for having me.
Meanwhile, on the reality TV beat, have you got an update for us, Viv?
Goodness, where do you want to start? I might just start with Big Brother, which relaunched.
Let's start with Big Brother.
Relaunched recently on 10. One of the things that I uncovered before it launched was I delved into the terms and conditions of applying for Big Brother, not because I wanted to apply, just because I wanted to see how these things have changed since various controversies have hit that show over the 25 odd years it's been on and off the air. And one of the things it made very clear was that this year, if you wanted to be a housemate, you could not work for a media company, be it an online media outlet, be it a television network, whatever it may be, you can't have worked there, and the people you live with can't work there.
That was very disappointing news for me, Dave.
And yet, when the show started, we saw that a man named Michael, who is the CEO and publisher of a publishing company called Nuclear Media, was there. And I recognised him because I'd done an interview with him previously when he relaunched FHM, the Lads Mag, in Australia recently, having previously published the likes of Maxim here. So I would contend that is a media company. He does work for the media. So I just sort of wondered how that came to be, given that Endemol Shine and 10 made such a point that this year would be real people. I'm not.
And what was the answer? What was the explanation?
Look, I'm not implying that people who work in media aren't real people, but they had a strategic decision where it was meant to be back to basics, not people who were chasing fame, not people who were looking to promote their media brands or get a radio gig or end up being a controversial television commentator. And I think that Michael probably does fall into that bracket. He describes himself as somebody who hates woke people. He hates cyclists on footpaths. I actually agree with him on that one. The Channel 10's answer to me was a little bit vague. I asked them directly why they sort of breached their own conditions, or if perhaps there wasn't transparency throughout the process or a misunderstanding. And they just sort of simply explained to me Michael's job, which I already knew. And then they said Michael was chosen by Big Brother as he is outspoken, opinionated, mature, brings a no-nonsense attitude to the house, is a single dad to three teens, and represents a demographic that no one else represents in the house. So look, 10 and Endemol made the rules. I guess they're allowed to break them if they want.
I guess so. Well, I guess we try to be for all demographics. Remember to follow Medialand on the ABC Listen app.
And what's your independent podcast about? Pitch it to us. We would love to hear from you. Email us at medialand@abc.net.au.
Thank you to our producer, Rob Kelly. We'll catch you the same time next week in your feeds and on Radio National.
See you, Tim.
Toodle pip, Viv.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.